From the empty enclosure of the plant's powerhouse, Reardon heard her voice screaming, "Hank!" It sounded like a scream of terror. He ran in the direction of the voice. He found her standing in the middle of a room, her hands bleeding, her stockings torn, her suit smeared with dust, a bunch of papers clutched in her hand. "Hank, what does this look like?" she asked, pointing at an odd piece of wreckage at her feet. Her voice had the intense, obsessed tone of a person stunned by a shock, cut off from reality. "What does it look like? Are you hurt? What happened?" "No." "Oh, never mind. Don't look at me. I'm all right. Look at this." "Do you know what that is?"
"What did you do to yourself?"
"I had to dig it out of there. I'm all right."
"You're shaking."
"You will, too, in a moment. Hank, look at it. Just look and tell me what you think it is."
He glanced down, then looked attentively. Then he was sitting on the floor, studying the object intently. "It's a queer way to put a motor together," he said, frowning.
"Read this," she said, extending the pages.
He read, looked up, and said, "Good God." She was sitting on the floor beside him, and for a moment they could say nothing else.
"It was the coil," she said.
She felt as if her mind were racing. She could not keep up with all the things which a sudden blast had opened to her vision, and her words came hurtling against one another.
"It was the coil that I noticed first, because I'd seen drawings like it, not quite, but something like it years ago when I was in school. It was in an old book. It was given up as impossible, long, long ago. But I liked to read everything I could about railroad motors. That book said that there was a time when men were thinking of it. They worked on it. They spent years on experiments, but they couldn't solve it, and they gave it up. It was forgotten for generations. I didn't think that any living scientist ever thought of it now, but someone did. Someone has solved it. Now, today. Hank, do you understand? Those men long ago tried to invent a motor that would draw static electricity from the atmosphere, convert it, and create its own power as it went along. They couldn't do it. They gave it up." She pointed at the broken shape.
"But there it is."
He nodded. He was not smiling. He sat looking at the remnant, intent on some thought of his own. It did not seem to be a happy thought. "Hank, don't you understand what this means? It's the greatest revolution in power motors since the internal combustion engine. Greater than that, it wipes everything out and makes everything possible. To hell with Dwight Sanders and all of them. Who will want to look at a diesel? Who will want to worry about oil, coal, or refueling stations? Do you see what I see? A brand new locomotive half the size of a single diesel unit and with 10 times the power? A self-generator working on a few drops of fuel with no limits to its energy. The cleanest, swiftest, cheapest means of motion ever devised. Do you see what this will do to our transportation systems and to the country? In about 1 year?"
There was no spark of excitement in his face. He said slowly, "Who designed it? Why was it left here?"
"We'll find out."
He weighed the pages in his hand reflectively. "Dagny," he asked, "if you don't find the man who made it, will you be able to reconstruct that motor from what is left?"
She took a long moment, then the word fell with a sinking sound. "No."
"Nobody will." "He had it all right. It worked, judging by what he writes here. It's the greatest thing I've ever laid eyes on. It was. We can't make it work again. To supply what's missing would take a mind as great as his."
"I'll find him. If I have to drop every other thing I'm doing."
"And if he's still alive."
She heard the unstated guess in the tone of his voice. "Why do you say it like that?"
"I don't think he is. If he were, would he leave an invention of this kind to rot on a junk pile? Would he abandon an achievement of this size? If he were still alive, you would have had the locomotives with the self-generators years ago. And you wouldn't have had to look for him, because the whole world would know his name by now."
"I don't think this model was made so very long ago."
He looked at the paper of the manuscript and at the rusty tarnish of the motor. "About 10 years ago, I'd guess. Maybe a little longer."
"We've got to find him, or somebody who knew him. This is more important
than anything owned or manufactured by anyone today. I don't think we'll find him. And if we don't, nobody will be able to repeat his performance. Nobody will rebuild his motor. There's not enough of it left. It's only a lead, an invaluable lead. But it would take the sort of mind that's born once in a century to complete it. Do you see our present-day motor designers attempting it? No. There's not a first-rate designer left. There hasn't been a new idea in motors for years. That's one profession that seems to be dying, or dead. Hank, do you know what that motor would have meant if built? He chuckled briefly. I'd say about 10 years added to the life of every person in this country, if you consider how many things it would have made easier and cheaper to produce, how many hours of human labor it would have released for other work, and how much more anyone's work would have brought him. Locomotives? What about automobiles and ships and airplanes with a motor of this kind? And tractors and power plants? All hooked to an unlimited supply of energy, with no fuel to pay for except for a few pennies worth to keep the converter going. That motor could have set the whole country in motion and on fire. It would have brought an electric light bulb into every hole, even into the homes of those people we saw down in the valley. It would have? It will. I'm going to find the man who made it. We'll try. He rose abruptly, but stopped to glance down at the broken remnant and said with a chuckle that was not gay, "There was the first motor for the John Galt line." Then he spoke in the brusque manner of an executive. "First, we'll try to see if we can find their personnel office here. We'll look for their records if there's any left. We want the names of their research staff and their engineers. I don't know who owns this place now, and I suspect that the owners will be hard to find, or they wouldn't have let it come to this. Then we'll go over every room in the laboratory. Later, we'll get a few engineers to fly here and comb the rest of the place." They started out, but she stopped for a moment on the threshold. "Hank, that motor was the most valuable thing inside this factory," she said, her voice low. "It was more valuable than the whole factory and everything it ever contained. Yet it was passed up and left in the refuse. It was the one thing nobody found worth the trouble of taking."
"That's what frightens me about this," he answered.
The personnel office did not take them long. They found it by the sign which was left on the door, but it was the only thing left. There was no furniture inside, no papers, nothing but the splinters of smashed windows. They went back to the room of the motor. Crawling on hands and knees, they examined every scrap of the junk that littered the floor. There was little to find. They put aside the papers that seemed to contain laboratory notes, but none referred to the motor, and there were no pages of the manuscript among them. The popcorn wrappers and the whiskey bottle testified to the kind of invading hordes that had rolled through the room, like waves washing the remnants of destruction away to unknown bottoms. They put aside a few bits of metal that could have belonged to the motor, but these were too small to be of value. The motor looked as if parts of it had been ripped off, perhaps by someone who thought he could put them to some customary use. What had remained was too unfamiliar to interest anybody. On aching knees, her palms spread flat upon the gritty floor, she felt the anger trembling within her, the hurting, helpless anger that answers the sight of desecration. She wondered whether someone's diapers hung on a clothesline made of the motor's missing wires, whether its wheels had become a rope pulley over a communal well, whether its cylinder was now a pot containing geraniums on the windowsill of the sweetheart of the man with the whiskey bottle. There was a remnant of light on the hill, but a blue haze was moving in upon the valleys, and the red and gold of the leaves was spreading to the sky in strips of sunset. It was dark when they finished. She rose and leaned against the empty frame of the window for a touch of cool air on her forehead. The sky was dark blue. It could have set the whole country in motion and on fire. She looked down at the motor. She looked out at the country. She moaned suddenly, hit by a single long shudder, and dropped her head on her arm, standing pressed to the frame of the window. "What's the matter?" he asked. She did not answer. He looked out. Far below in the valley, in the gathering night, there trembled a few pale smears, which were the lights of tallow candles.